RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
David Henderson is a New Zealand property developer based in Christchurch. In 1994, he founded the libertarian magazine, The Free Radical. Of course, Lindsay Perigo is one of our contributors, so that might ring a bell. He was also a student of Zenith Applied Philosophy. And there's a quote on his wiki page regards that. It really sparked my interest. I found it greatly stimulating and inspiring, immensely so. They got a terribly bad name, a bad rap. Now, if you're thinking, I remember that name, you may recall an epic battle, and I'll ask him about that, with the IRD. David Henderson has had a roller coaster life in business and probably a roller coaster life in general, and he joins us on RCR. David, it's great to have you. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, thank you, Paul. It's a real privilege to be here. I'm a big fan of your station. I'm a big fan of what you do and the reasons for doing it.
I'm curious about a whole lot of things, so I'm just going to work through the list, if you don't mind.
You bet.
And congratulations on having a Wikipedia page dedicated to you. Okay, so in no particular order, what is Zenith Applied Philosophy?
Oh, it's a it was an organization, is an organization who was advancing a very clear, specific, unequivocal philosophic platform that fundamentally advocated or turned on the principle of personal responsibility. And I guess I enjoyed that immensely because as a young man, it taught me about the significance of personal responsibility to the extent now that I classify myself as a responsibility absolutist. In other words, you know, I think that one of the great sources of pleasure and satisfaction in one's life is getting to a point where one is, as very much as possible, taking complete responsibility for one's life and, of course, for all the choices one makes in the course of a life.
So it's the journey of life, is it, in a way?
Well, you know, Paul, it's an interesting thing because, you know, philosophy is so fundamental and people don't get this, sadly. We all have a philosophy. We all actually have a philosophy. It's our view of life. It's our view of the nature of existence, you could say, or nature of the world or universe that we live in. And it's the values that we hold that constitute that philosophy. And, you know, I think it's a very important thing to do is to be able to properly identify your values. I mean, if you can't articulate them, if you haven't figured out things that you're willing to die for, you're willing to make sacrifices for, then you end up just being a leaf blowing in the wind. And we see enough of that. I mean, goodness knows the whole genesis of Voices for Freedom and your radio station is born out of as much as anything, out of a frustration of seeing people who are leaves blowing in the wind. They just do whatever they're told. They go wherever they're pushed. Someone says boo, they jump. You know, I mean, that's no way to live your life. If you want to have a meaningful existence, you need to know what your philosophy is. And you need to know what your values are.
What sort of upbringing did you have?
Oh, I was sort of born on the ended up on the wrong side of the tracks. My dad died when I was very young. My mother sort of struggled trying to bring up three kids. She did a stellar job, other than with me. I was sort of very entrepreneurial. I went through high school, did a year at university, decided it was absolute nonsense. Funnily enough, I got stuck in a sociology class. I don't know whether you've had the gross misfortune to do that, but it was so foreign to me, the garbage that was being advanced there, that I ran screaming out of the place and never went back. And from that time on, pursued a whole bunch of entrepreneurial urges and aspirations.
Entrepreneurialism.
Yeah.
That's always interested me, and I would consider myself sort of an entrepreneur because I get ideas and I try them.
Yeah.
Can you remember, because I can remember the moment when I thought, hey, that's a good idea. That would work. I should do that. And I remember that moment, and it was when I was working at a radio station and the Eurythmics were coming.
Yes.
And you know, I had an idea to do a, you know, paid for sort of fly around the country with them.
Yeah.
It was probably never going to fly, but I just remember thinking, that's a great idea. I should push that. I never did.
Yeah.
Can you remember a moment when something popped into your head, you know, entrepreneurial thought that sort of kind of got that up and running for you?
Paul, I could spend the next couple of hours telling you those.
okay.
But I do remember as a young kid being, you know, my mother did it pretty hard financially, and that sort of puts a resolve in you that somehow or other you're going to figure out a way to make some money and not be so frustrated about money and getting by and meeting expenses. And so that sort of got my entrepreneurial juices, for lack of a better term, going. And, you know, I remember. And my mother was a dyed-in-the-wool eternal pessimist. And so risk averse. And I do remember as a young kid, this is 12, 13, having some cool ideas about things I could do. And sitting just, you know, by that stage, my elder sisters had left home, and I'd be sitting at the dining table with her, enthusiastically imparting my entrepreneurial considerations and thoughts. And she would look at me like I was on drugs, saying, well, you know, if that idea was any good, someone would have already done it.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
Which is hilarious in retrospect. But fortunately, it didn't daunt my my intentions and my motivations. And no, if you're talking about the Eurythmics, I was just thinking, as you were saying that, one of my early ventures was I got a whole bunch of merchandising rights to ABBA. When they were big, and they were, and I got them for New Zealand, and did very, very well out of that.
I can imagine. Yeah.
And then I hooked up with some promoters, the Mushroom Records guys, Gadinskys. I don't know whether they mean anything to you.
I know the label for sure.
Yeah. And they're in Melbourne, and they had, their young guys done a great job building up that record label, had a number of bands. They were either managing and producing and recording for. And I got some merchandising rights for their stuff and did that as well. But no, they were all a minor event. One thing you missed out that Lindsay Perigo and I did, I set up a radio station in the mid 90s as well called Radio Liberty.
I've heard Lindsay talk about that. Yeah.
Have you? And we had studios in Auckland, Wellington, Christchurch. We had, you had to go out and buy radio frequencies back then, Paul. It's obviously a lot easier today when you can go on the internet.
And they were expensive.
Oh, we paid literally into the millions of dollars for back then for AM frequencies. Then we had to go and cut deals with different people for transmitter space and so forth. And I ended up doing some deals with Radio Rima. I don't even know if Radio Rima's on air these days.
Yeah, I think they're still around.
Are they?
Yep.
And then for some reason or another, someone on air was blaspheming, and so then Radio Rima wanted to terminate.
Was that in the contract?
Yeah.
No blaspheming.
And we even had a better one, is that even before we went on air, I rented some space for our studios in the Salvation Army building in Queen Street. And we moved in there. And then the Salvation Army somehow decided they had the devil incarnate in their building. And so they came to me and did everything they could to try and break this lease agreement that was barely, the ink wasn't dry on it. And they were trying to break that. And in the end, they paid us I think it was $80,000 to leave. I thought $80,000 for a capital staffed radio station,
not too shabby,
was a hot deal. I mean, the appalling thing about it was literally 2 weeks later, they had their national appeal, and I think they raised 800 odd thousand. So they gave us 10% of their national appeal because philosophically or politically, they didn't like us. And so we moved on. But we set up a radio station, which was glorious because you just had, just like Reality Check Radio does, you just had this uninhibited dissemination of political free market political philosophy, which was just great. So very cool.
Way ahead of your time, Dave. I think it was back in 91 that Lindsay said they were all brain dead and walked out.
Yeah, it was.
But we as a country weren't sort of ready for that, were we? Yet?
Well, you know what? I tell you what, I learned a great thing, and I think it's a good lesson for you guys, quite frankly, is that I used to get depressed because we'd go into survey and we'd get our ratings and I would look at it. And I think we had sort of at any one time a listenership of about 30,000. Which actually wasn't too bad.
Not too bad.
You know, and of course, you can imagine, and I guarantee you have the same problem, I was struggling to attract advertisers and all the other mainstream media were going out there bagging us and threatening to cut deals, to stop the deals other people already had.
Yeah.
They had with advertisers.
If predatory.
They advertised with us and, anyway, it was only after we closed after 18 months or so, because it was financially unsustainable. We were just bleeding money. And it was only after that I realized the real upside of what we were doing, because I encountered so many people who were frustrated that it had gone off air. And what they explained to me is, sure, in a way, we were preaching to the converted, for lack of a better metaphor. But what we were doing was intellectually arming people with that, you know, people had a gut feel that things that were going on politically were wrong, but they weren't able to properly articulate the intellectual argument behind that. And they got that from this station. They got that. I mean, We had Lindsay doing the breakfast show. We had Deborah Coddington, if you remember her, doing 9 to midday. Then we had some other business related stuff that was going on after that, and then we had evening talk back. So we were our hosts that we had on were savvy enough that they were able to do great interviews with people, pulling them apart, and particularly politicians, and they were able to give people a structure, an intellectual structure to support the arguments, to support, we'll say, our side of the political fence.
It's interesting you say that, because I think it's fair to say in our experience, and we've been going a bit now for a bit of time, is that... You know, you mentioned politicians being pulled apart and being obviously willing to be interviewed or chatted with, or whatever you want to call it, on your radio station.
Yeah.
We've found that there's resistance to that, or there has been. It's slowly sort of easing up because people are realizing that we're not all mad and there's a sizable audience there, to the point where I claim that we influenced the election in terms of New Zealand First's vote to get over the line. And then we saw that coalition agreement and we were jumping up and down for a bit, but we've got a bit more real since then. So there's been a sort of like a pushback against that free flow of information. So there's a fear. There's some kind of fear out there, isn't there?
Yeah. Well, you know, most of political discussion and political debate turns on feelings, you know, and generally speaking, politicians abhor it when you're trying to deal with them based on principles, to drill in on principles. And they'll, you know, and that's where you get this whole mad brush off, which people say, oh, well, it's just common sense. You know, I mean, it's just common sense that during the COVID nonsense that we should stand 2 meters apart. It's just common sense that you should wear a mask when you're on your own in the car driving to work, you know.
Or swimming.
Yeah, or swimming. Or wear a mask while you walk to your table at the restaurant, but you can take it off while you eat. I mean, you know, no one wants to deal, as everyone observed there, no one wants to deal in principles, realities. No one wants to deal in logic. And so there is, at a political level, just that appalling behavior of just brushing people off and coming out with, you know, trite nonsense like, you know, it's just common sense. So,
tell me about Christchurch.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in Christchurch, and I also have a home in Queenstown. And my wife was there when we had the 2011 earthquakes, and she's very, very reluctant to come back to Christchurch. She made a home there as a consequence. So I've got some commercial projects and property development I'm doing in Christchurch. So I do spend quite a bit of time here, and regularly get chided for doing so. You know, Christchurch is a very conservative town. Mm. It's not an overly affluent town. I grew up here, and so with that, you naturally have affections for the place, you know, in the sort of the way that you have affections for your mother or father or family. There's a fundamental problem, Paul. The older you get, the more familiarity has currency. And so I'm very familiar with Christchurch, and so it's a bit lazy in a way that I find it very easy to do property development here. Though Queenstown, which we're also active in as a marketplace, is a far, far more exciting, dynamic, and commercially viable marketplace. But Christchurch, funnily enough, I've generally down on it, but it seems to be actually getting up some speed and seems to be very popular at the moment. The university has its highest roll that it's ever had, which is extraordinary. I'm aware of a number of families out of Auckland whose children might have otherwise gone to Dunedin, who are now coming to Christchurch. It doesn't have a thriving, highly energetic downtown space or urban space like Wellington, Auckland have. And from a urban perspective, it's cursed by the fact that it's, as far as the eye can see, it rolls out as a flat town. Mm. And the best cities in the world, if you look around and think about it, are ones that are geographically stuffed. And as a consequence, whoever lives there has to work their space a lot harder. And, I mean, the classic example, of course, is Manhattan, you know, which is just a little island. It's completely buggered. But it's got the most dynamic urban space on the face of the planet, in my view, as a consequence of that. You know, Wellington is cool. You know, I mean, if with a bit of global warming, Wellington might be
happening now. We've had great weather.
There you go. Oh, so you're in Wellington, are you?
At the moment, though, I'm heading to Queenstown, funnily enough.
To live?
To live. The RCR studio base has been set up in Queenstown.
Yes, I'm aware where your studio is in Queenstown.
And I'm happy to be moving to the South Island because I just feel like it's more sensible. And I don't know why I think that, but I do.
No, well, it's a lot more conservative. It's a lot more peaceful. I travel most weeks to Queenstown, but I rarely drive. But when I do drive, I still find it remarkable that between Christchurch and Queenstown, I can drive for 10, 15 minutes sometimes and not see another car.
And
there's nowhere in the North Island you can do that. So it's a well-kept secret in lots of respects, Paul. But, you know, no, Queenstown's world-class. It's gorgeous. And it's now got an amenity level, which is achieved over the last few years, which means you can be there and have all the things you want and live a great life. So, I'll look forward to encountering you there at some stage.
Yeah, it'll be obvious. There'll be the cap and the T-shirt and the number plates around and the umbrella if I need
there
it.
RCR
on it. The epic struggles. I mean, I'm sure that every property development has its struggle sessions.
Sure.
But this one with the IRD, and this is where I know your name because I was in news and I remember reading, now I can't remember the specifics of it, but I do remember reading a series of stories when that was playing out back in the mid-90s.
Sure.
So I don't know how much you want to go through this, but I guess, you know, why you? Why they have a go at you?
Well, I am a loudmouth, Paul. Which you've become too. So there might be a great lesson in all of this for you.
I'm listening.
I am a loudmouth. Funnily enough, all of this issue with the IRD started coincidentally with me launching Radio Liberty, which I was just previously describing. And I don't believe that was coincidental, but I'm ridiculously stubborn. I abhor a bully. And when you come across a bully, I don't know any other way to behave than one hunkers down and, if necessary, to coin a phrase, you sell the farm to go to war and put things right.
Yeah.
So that was my plan there. What I encountered was just ridiculous, outrageous, and it was appalling bully boy behavior, which. In a way, is all government is. Government is just force and bullying. You know, that's the whole state is that. And so when I encountered this, you know, at the same time, you get all these platitudes about how, you know, we're here to help and we're here to look after you and, you know, we're here to listen, all that, which is just crap. You know, the government can't do that. And unfortunately, a lot of the people, not all the people, but a lot of the people that the state attracts as employees are people who probably got bullied at school. And this is their chance to
Come
get
back.
Even. So I hunkered down. I thought, you know what? I'm going to go the distance here because my hands are clean and I know I'm right. And I'm going to go the distance. And more importantly, Paul, and I think this is a very important thing that I learned, you've got to find a way to enjoy the process. When you
Okay, so what, treat it like a movie playing out or some sort of
in a
show?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, no. I had no idea that ultimately a movie would be produced from it. But I thought, at a minimum, I would document my story and tell my story in the fullness of time. Now, I have to say, I was very, very fortunate to have my dear friend Rodney Hyde, having just entered Parliament, and you know Rodney well, and Rodney is more tenacious than I am, and he abhors a bully as much as I do, and he was, as a MP, and they're probably, I doubt we'll ever see an MP like him ever again, but he was just not afraid to stand up, to speak out, to take on ultimately the biggest government department that exists. And I know he got threatened and he got warned by ministers and other politicians that he shouldn't be doing all of this. But fortunately, Rodney's of a personality that that just inspired him more. So anyway, I went the distance. But the part of the story I'm most proud about, Paul, is these guys smack me up. They're miserable pricks. And at the end of the day, they had to cut me a check. Actually, I insisted it was a cash check. And for the first time in IRD's history, they had to produce a cash check.
Someone had to manually write it, probably.
Yeah, which I then went and cashed. I can't remember what it was for now. I remember Rodney had a photocopy of the check on his office wall at Parliament. I think it was either $70,000 or $80,000. And this is back in 98 or 99. But by that time, they had bankrupted me and I had had all sorts of issues. But I came out of bankruptcy and I'm going to say 2 years later, I had a real estate agent ring me and said, "Oh, look, I was doing some property deals. I've got a great property for you and I need to come and see you." And I said, "Okay." I knew the guy. Well, he turned up. And he had a listing for the IRD's head office in Christchurch.
Great.
We had 500 staff went to work and were all the bullies who had bullied me. So I said, "I just need a copy of the lease." And the first thing I looked for was to see if the IRD had any naming rights under their lease, which they didn't. And so, much to the chagrin of everyone around me, I bought the building. People were saying, "Oh, come on, this is just an emotional purchase." I said, no, I've got a very clear view of what I want to do with it. Of course, I had no idea what I was going to do with it. So for something like the next 6 years, all these miserable pricks who had beat me up had to go to work at Henderson House. So so I thought that was pretty cool. And then I converted it into a fabulous hotel, which still exists today. I've since sold it around earthquake and GFC times. But it's a stunning hotel. It was the largest hotel in the South Island at the time, and it did enormously well. So that was doubly pleasurable in being able to, as I regularly told people, take a great building and finally give it a constructive and meaningful use. So
that's a classic. That story is a classic. So someone from high up,
yes,
out of the, you mentioned Radio Liberty,
yes,
what, called somebody else or said, "This guy,
you gotta believe it, you gotta believe it." I had 4 weeks after we started Radio Liberty, I had the police raid my home on a search warrant from a complaint from the IRD. It was just appalling. And there's few things that sort of turn your stomach more than the state coming into your house and going through all your drawers and your wardrobes and office. It's I hold private property as sacrosanct, and the notion of that is just repugnant. And so that's when I decided, I'm going to go the distance here. And look, I help a lot of people these days. We have a little organization we call the Equalization Bureau, where people who are getting bullied by the state, if we think that they're being unfairly treated, we will support them in terms of running their court cases and so forth. We've had some good success. And I have two rules, which I say to these people, is one, if we're going to support you, you've got to commit to go the distance. And two, most importantly, you've got to find a way to enjoy the process.
Yeah.
Because nothing frustrates a bully more if you're enjoying it. And
they want to see you on the back foot. They want to see you intimidated, right?
Yeah, they want to see you genuflect and, you know, tug a forelock and say, "I'm sorry," you know. Yeah, and
get on
and
your knees.
And look, there is a pattern to all of this, Paul, which, you know, a lot of your listeners, it'll resonate, is that people like the IRD know that when they do start focusing on someone and putting pressure on them, there's a number of things happen. These people's health breaks down. Invariably, their relationship breaks down. Their matrimonial or romantic relationship breaks down. Their business suffers considerably. And, you know, these people become, and quite understandably, a mess as a consequence of this. And they play on that. They play on that. And that's how they succeed, is because people get to a point where they are stressed out. They are in such a pickle and such a mess that they give up. But, you know, to anyone that's one of your listeners that should be listening to this, that is getting smacked up, you know, you've just got to pick yourself up and you've got to just keep going with it, because you're right. That's how they succeed, is when they break people.
Any idea who was gunning for you?
No, I've made a myriad of official information act requests. I had huge issues with those, which you guys will understand.
Slow-walked.
And in fact, just tangentially speaking, Paul, if there was one thing that I could affect, which I think could happen, maybe there's two aspects to it. One is the ombudsman needs to be funded so they can properly deal with the complaints that exist, because every ombudsman I've ever dealt with has told me, look, I'm sorry, it's going to take ages, we can't deal with this, we just don't have the budget. And so government, doesn't matter which, National, Labour, Coalition, whatever, they all overtly underfund the ombudsman's office because, you know, it's a mechanism, it's a tool. You know, they all say, oh, we've got the Official Information Act, we're open government, but we're never going to give the ombudsman enough funds so they can properly deal with our poor behaviour around that, you know. And the second thing is you, if you could make bureaucrats liable financially in some way for breaches of the Official Information Act, you know, let alone breaches in every other respect, that would be significant too in terms of changing behaviour. But, you know, it's going to be some time before something like that can be effected. But, no, the answer to your question is I don't know. I don't know who that would have been. I can guess. I can imagine who it might have been. But I think it just exists, and I've experienced it subsequently with other government departments, and I've caught them out. I had another government department that was prosecuting me, and we got hold of, through the Official Information Act, a whole bunch of emails where they were all high-fiving and celebrating having laid charges. Yeah. So I don't know if it's a particular person. I just think it's a general attitude that exists. You know, and
the culture of the institutions within government.
That's exactly it. The culture is such, and the type of person that gets attracted there means that when a tall poppy or someone sticks their head out, you know, there's sort of a feeling, oh, this guy needs to be cut down. He needs a good smack around the head. And I know for me, this is how naive I am, Paul. I thought after I had gone through my IRD stuff, Rodney in large part was managed to generate a huge amount of publicity for it. Rodney got a parliamentary inquiry into the culture of the IRD, and he got the commissioner's head and the deputy commissioner's head, and for a moment it did change. And, you know, I naively thought, oh, well, that's great. No one will ever come after me again. but in fact, surprise, it's the opposite. You know, I think you have all these people now who think, oh, well, if they could get my head on a pike and march around town with it, they would be high-fiving each other again. And to this very day, I have huge problems with the IRD. Unbelievable treatment. from time to time, there's a man at the IRD who mans the Henderson desk currently. He's only been on it for about 12, 18 months. And he's actually trying very hard. But there's some of the bizarre stuff I've been dealing with. No one else in the department's allowed to talk to me other than him. He's civilized.
The fear of bankruptcy. You've been in that situation, I think, more than once, right?
Sure.
And that freaks people out. How do you?
Yeah.
I'm just curious. How did you deal with that? Because that potentially is a reputational issue. You want to carry on doing, you know, what you naturally do, and that's it. Sounds like property development. There's a big money aspect to that, and trust and all credibility. Sure. So, what's your attitude to that, and how did you deal with it?
Well, look, it's not an ideal circumstance, but, you know, the first time I had it with the IRD, the second time was as a consequence of personal guarantees that I gave that came to haunt me after the GFC in 2008, 9, 10. where I was desperately trying to refinance properties, sell properties and do other things. And just about every funder I dealt with had gone into administration themselves and had accountants or lawyers running them who just wanted to, you know, roll things up and move on. And so I ended up, I didn't choose to go bankrupt. I fought like crazy to avoid it because I always saw bankruptcy as a wimpy way out of one's problems.
Right.
Yeah, you're right. It comes with a reputational stigma, which you have to work from. But, you know, Paul, I mean, it's the story, isn't it, that, you know, the real assets one has in life, the real things of any value one has in life, are one's perseverance, one's creativity, one's energy, one's determination, all of those things. And no one can ever take those away from you. Those are things you have to give up. And if you don't give them up, then you've got something pretty sound and pretty solid to get back on your feet with and make things happen. So I might have an overly cavalier attitude toward it, but it happens. Particularly when you're a property developer. I mean, virtually all my peers went bankrupt in the GFC for the same reason. They provided personal guarantees. And it's interesting, some of them have got back on their feet. Others have been so daunted by that and intimidated by it. And it is intimidating, you know, that they haven't got back on their feet. But no, it's just another hurdle in life that one has to put behind one. And as I said, the real things of any worth or value are still there.
The role of failure in life.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the freedom to fail is one of the great freedoms, you know, and because it's only through failure, really, that we learn a lot about ourselves, we learn a lot about life, but more importantly, we see the need and have the opportunity to correct our behavior and go on to live a more meaningful, you know, meaningful life. No, failure is critical. And as you will be aware, I mean, we're living in a society where it's seen as an anathema and something that we need to eradicate. But no, it's critical. And, you know, at the end of the day, it's failure or the potential of failure that gives success its value, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, if there wasn't the concept of failure hanging over one, then success wouldn't be as sweet and significant and as worth striving for as it is.
Yeah, I think of, I'm an enthusiast on, you know, space and aerospace stuff. And I remember that Apollo 1 fire, you know, when the three astronauts died, that was an epic fail. But that actually got them to the moon, that failure.
Yes. Yeah, didn't it? Yeah, No, that's so true.
Well, it's tragic, but, you know.
Yeah, no. I mean, any meaningful life is actually riddled with failure, problems and issues. And, you know, it's like the whole concept of suffering is in lots of ways, you know, socialism is about the state, or it's about the avoidance of suffering, the avoidance of failure. And it turns on the basis that no one should be failing, no one should be suffering. But and that's why one of the reasons why politically and economically it's always been and always will be a complete failure, because you can't eradicate in day-to-day life the reality and concept of failure. And much as it may pain you, there's times when you have to watch family members, friends fail, and know that it's a wonderful opportunity for them if they embrace it and handle it properly.
Yeah, it's like life set up to have some fails. You've kind of got to live a life, have those experiences, and not be wrapped in cotton wool. Where do you see things right now, Dave? You know, the country you're living in,
Sure.
What we've been through and the, I don't know, the opportunities ahead. Is it like the old days? Is it worse than the old days? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that the last Labor government you had was the single worst government we've ever had in New Zealand. I don't think the average person on the street begins to understand the costs that were burdened on us, not just with the COVID nonsense, but with the borrowing and the printing of money that went on, and how long it's going to take for that to work its way through. You know, I do have, unfortunately, a rather dystopian view of the future, not the immediate future, but the long-term future. I live in New Zealand, not just because I am a New Zealand citizen, was born here, and I could probably at various times have chosen to live anywhere in the world, but because I think that geopolitically that there's a lot of madness. It's in the Northern Hemisphere more than it is here, and I think that's only going to get worse, particularly Europe and the US. And I think that, you know, much as New Zealand's isolation has been its bane for 150, 60, 70 years, I think its isolation now is its one of its greatest virtues or assets. And so I am happy to live in New Zealand for that reason. Politically, things never go on a straight line. And there's always an advance of madness, socialism, collectivism of some sort. And then there's some pushback, Paul. But the pushback is never far as it needs to be, you know. And we're seeing it now, aren't we, where we rejected the Labor government, and implicitly in that a lot of their madness and advancement of all sorts of social and economic agendas. And, you know, we have a coalition that we've all put some, you know, grand hope in, but it won't push back anywhere near as far as it needs to. Mm. And so we'll get some pushback, and it's great to see it slowly happening. And who knows? I mean, this might be a one-term government, you know. It's interesting, isn't it, around the world that that COVID governments are all being rejected, you know, which is exciting that, you know, people have suddenly realised the fallacy, nonsense and lie of it all. But, you know, I mean, the UK is going to be a complete pigsty after the next election. God knows what happens in the US, you know.
Oh, man, you couldn't write that script, could you?
You can't. You can only just be grateful that we're a distance, some considerable distance from it, and we can enjoy the spectacle and the entertainment value of it. And then you saw what happened yesterday. France is calling an election. You saw what happened in the EU election. You know, New Zealand's a stunning place. The South Island, New Zealand's a particularly stunning place. There is great opportunities here. And all I've done is set up my life so that I avoid the state as much as possible. If someone wants to pick a fight with me, I roll up my sleeves and go for it and enjoy it as a pastime. I don't play golf or own a boat, so...
plenty of time on your hands and you're not working.
So I can go and do that.
Yeah.
And commercially, there's opportunities here.
Okay, to wind up, it's been a great chat, by the way. What are you, at your stage of life now, have you got it mapped out how you're going to kind of go from here? Is there any slowing down? I guess you don't want to be bored or you know,
no.
Around sort of and trying to pass the time somehow. What are your thoughts on that?
No, my view is to, at a personal level, to live my values, Paul. And then beyond that, I put energy, effort, and money into trying to advance those values, particularly at a political level. Wherever I have the opportunity, you know. So, no, I have a number of things up my sleeve as aspirations. I have friends and peers who talk about retirement. I think the notion is abhorrent. I get great satisfaction from my commercial activities, tremendous satisfaction from that. And so long as I have breath in me, Paul, I'll be doing those.
All right. Well, that sounds like a way to go. Dave Henderson, it's been really interesting chatting with you. Thanks for coming on our radio station.
Well, thank you so much, Paul. And thank you to you guys for what you do. Because anyone who can proudly set out their values and overtly defends them in the way you guys are deserves every bit of support that's possible out there. So well done.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.